from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Summer at the Palladium now through August.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today, I'll find out about a visual art exhibit featuring the work of young audiences teaching artists.
I'll chat with Nat Evans about his site-specific music installation.
And I'll get a look at the ancient Nigerian art exhibit at the IMA. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call.
What will we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. A teaching artist is a term coined a few years back to describe professional artists, both visual and performing, who also work as arts educators in the schools. A new exhibit titled I Do What I Teach, I Am a Teaching Artist, explores the works of teaching artists who work with children ages 3 through 6 through young audiences of Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke with artist Meg Olson and Young Audiences President and CEO Joellen Florio Rossipo about this project.
Joellen, Meg, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Let's start off with what this phrase, teaching artist, means. This is something I think I first started hearing maybe about 10 years ago, really in association with young audiences and referring to all the professional artists that do their work through young audiences in the schools. Meg, what does it mean to you to be called a teaching artist or identify yourself as a teaching artist?
To be a teaching artist, the way I try to describe it to people is that I'm a professional artist, and I try to keep up on my professional work. I give myself goals as far as, you know, how many bodies of art I want to create in a year, and I bring those skills then into the classroom. And what I try to do is I try to generate enthusiasm for the arts with my students. And maybe the difference between what I do and what the art teacher does is that I don't have to follow a set curriculum. I try to piggyback off of the themes that the teacher is teaching. I do try to hit on the standards, the educational standards, but I feel like I have a little more freedom with what I teach. I can reach into any subject matter that I want to.
Tell me a little bit about your own work.
Well, my own work, I consider myself primarily a photographer. But I also do sculpture with clay work, and I paint murals.
So the work that you're doing when you're working with students, this is not exactly studio work. You're not exactly, you know, teaching a class on photography or on sculpture or working with clay necessarily, though that may be part of it.
I do a lot of clay workshops, and usually the focus is on hand building because I can't bring a wheel into the classroom. I talk a lot about the history of whatever subject matter I'm teaching. And then I try to identify what the teacher is trying to teach. And so I try to work in partnership with the teachers.
So it's really about working very closely with the teacher and not necessarily, and I guess what I mean by, you know, not studio work, it's not, you know, someone signs up for a class to learn how to, you know, make a hand sculpture out of clay with you. It's that you're going into an existing classroom, a teacher's classroom in the school, and adding to it, supplementing that.
Right. So I'm giving another dimension to what they're already learning.
Joellen, would you, I mean, talk with me about how you understand teaching artists, because you certainly work with, along with Meg, dozens, if not hundreds of artists who are now sort of identifying under that phrase, and many different types of artists, too.
Absolutely. Our teaching artists at Young Audiences are really in all the arts disciplines. I think what Meg said is absolutely true. We expect the very best artists from our artists. We expect our artists to be working artists, but bring that other dimension into the classroom where they are really sharing ideas and experiences. And I hear so many teaching artists say that it's a real learning process for them. They learn from children because there's a real transition from honing your craft and working individually as an artist to doing very collaborative work when you enter the classroom. And I think that that is a big shift for many artists, but I think many find it very rewarding.
I think that's a great point. And Meg, you were nodding your head there, because so much of what an artist does is often very solitary, but yet obviously a classroom is not that way at all.
No, no, not at all. And I'd have to say I'm inspired by my students' work as well. So I've actually done bodies of work that's based off of things that I've taught and the inspiration that I've gained from my students.
Now, the show that's coming up that's at the Indie Fringe building, this is a show, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it's featuring a number of different young audiences artists, teaching artists, but specifically focusing on teaching artists who have been working in your preschool program, Joellen?
Absolutely. These are artists that have gone to the next step to really learn about early childhood pedagogy. So they have the experience in classroom management and working with the young child in allowing curriculum to emerge, which is very different from, the traditional school day in elementary school or middle school.
Because we're talking about kids 3 through 6 years old,
right.
More or less?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes,
so
young
much
children.
Younger. Yeah, and that means a totally different beast, I would imagine, than working with, a high school student, for example.
Yeah, yeah. The preschool children are a lot of fun. The biggest difference, I think, is they don't care about a finished project. So you mm-hmm. can set down clay in front of a preschool child, and they will make the coolest thing you've ever seen in your life, and you'll go put their name on it, and you'll turn around, and then they've squashed it, and they start all over again. So it's a lot of fun, and they have just amazing amounts of enthusiasm, and they're great. I love working with the preschool kids.
So what's the? I know that you wrestle with this in sort of explaining it to funders or to even partners. When a kid is so willing to be able to make something and then squash it like that, how do you sort of measure what they're attaining? I guess maybe the question is, what's the purpose of teaching art to a 3 or 4 year old?
I really think it's their experience and engagement, the very idea of getting their hands in clay. There are lots of things that go into that. They're learning a new vocabulary. Mm-hmm. They're learning how to work with an artist. They're learning how to work with children around them. But it's really about that interaction and that experience. We say that there are several core principles that every program should have. Experience is a very important one.
Mm-hmm.
But also the opportunity for children to create within that experience is so important.
So it's really using the arts as a tool to learning.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Just gaining confidence in your decision making.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to get, if you're making a little animal that has 4 legs and you're trying to get it to stand up and you give it 10 legs, it mm-hmm. might not be the animal.
Sounds like
that
you're speaking
know.
From experience here with a couple of these examples.
Yeah, very much, yeah. But I think it's a lot about building confidence. I try to incorporate. I ask open-ended questions so that this, there can be a story behind what the child is making, so mm-hmm. it helps them kind of think in a different way. Not that they've just created something, but that something may have a background to it, and the conversations that happen around the table, with the children too. I think that a lot of that is, a lot of learning moments right
being
there.
Being attentive to all those potential teaching moments.
Right.
Now, you partner with the day nurseries with this program?
That's right, with the day nurseries, Head Start, and several independent community centers who have early mm-hmm. childhood programs.
And this program's been going on for a while. I know you've got some important partners and funders that feel free to mention.
That's right. The program was initially funded by Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust, and that gave us an opportunity to really research early learning.
Mm-hmm.
And we had worked with them for several years, but most recently, and actually this year, and the work that is being featured that we'll see this year is through a grant from PNC's Grow Up Great initiative.
Yeah. Yeah, a great program that they've been really pushing just over the past year or so with PNC and early childhood learning. So now tell me about this exhibit that's taking place at Indie Fringe, opening for First Friday in August. It's an exhibit of, is it the work by the artists who are working in the Young Audiences programs, or is it documentation about the program or the kids' work or all of the above, or what is it?
It's actually photo documentation of the work of our teaching artists and the work they do with children.
Okay.
So you'll see lots of photos. I don't want to give it all away, but
you'll see
lots of photos of the artists interacting with children.
Okay. So it's an exhibit sort of documenting what the artists are doing with the children. So who are some of the other artists involved along with Meg?
Melly Hoppy and Susurrus, Naptown Jazz 5, Asante Touring Company, Adzook's Puppets, Will Gould and Dave Hepler, Lawrence Clark, Tamara Lowenthal and Jamie Gans, and Laura Friesen.
Neat. So quite a mix. I mean, as I'm hearing some of the names there, obviously you've got performing artists as you know with dance and jazz, as well as visual artists. So, I mean, the documentation, it sounds like that's pretty important in this process, since you might have a work that gets smashed. I keep going back to that. Mm-hmm. But the photo documentation, that's a big part of this process, right?
Yes, it is. You know, we talked about that earlier, this whole dilemma between the continuum of process and product. And we really feel that the process is so important. It gets a little harder. I think a lot of older children kind of self-impose this need to have a wonderful product.
Mm-hmm.
But as Meg was saying, we don't have that with young children. And it's very freeing because we can explore so much more and really get involved in the process.
Meg, as you've been working in this program for the past couple of years, how have you grown as an artist?
I think that...
Or as a teaching artist.
As a teaching artist, well, I think, for one thing, like I said, I think my work has been inspired by the students that I work with. I love kind of the honesty and the surprises that come out of the work that the children do, and so I try to bring that into my own work because, you know, I have a degree. I went to college. I've been making art for a long time. But I think sometimes, especially when you're working with the early childhood children, they don't have that background. So they might make something in the clay and they don't know how the material works. And by the time I get it back to my studio, it maybe has slumped over. But that might give it like this gestural quality that maybe my work has lost because I've got, all of this education behind me and I'm trying to, I know how the clay works and I know what to expect of it. So I think what I'm trying to do is just incorporate more of that element of surprise and taking it where maybe I don't expect it to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to get more back to the unexpectedness of the surprises that the materials can give to me.
Sure. Joellen, I'm going to sort of leave the last word with you here. We talked to Meg about how it sort of affects her as an artist, but how does it affect, do you think, early childhood learning by having a program like this? It sounds like you've developed a lot of new partners with this. I mean, what do you see as the importance of the role of the arts in early childhood learning, but also just in general, these sort of preschool programs?
I really think that engaging children in this way gives children opportunity to understand learning and become self-motivated. We're hearing so much right now about the full-day kindergarten and what children can achieve by being in school during that time. But I think it's more than just the amount of time a child is in school. I think it really has a lot to do with the quality experiences that we give them. We want kids to be turned on by the whole idea of learning. We want them to be inquisitive and creative and allowed to fail. We want them to try things and realize that they can do it again or there might be something that they've done. They see a quality about it that is unexpected, and that's what learning is really about. And so I think that this kind of program, the creativity and letting children innovate is what's going to help them to succeed later.
Travis DiNicola with artist Meg Olson and Young Audiences President and CEO Joellen Florio-Rossovo. The exhibit, I Do What I Teach, I Am a Teaching Artist, has its opening at the Indie Fringe Building on August 5th from 6 to 9. For more information, visit yaindie.org, yaindie.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Composer Nat Evans is an Indianapolis native who now lives in Seattle, but he's returning to his hometown to present an original site-specific music event that fuses nature, music, community, and subjectivity of experience. The event will take place just before sunset on Sunday, August 7th, at the American Legion Mall downtown. Sharon Gamble was curious about this project and reached Nat by phone recently.
Well, I know that you studied with Michael Shelley and Frank Felice at Butler University, and they are known, well known, in fact, for having a sense of humor and being sometimes wildly experimental. Were you experimental before you came under their influence as a composer?
I would say that, though I am not experimental in the same kinds of ways that they are, they foster people exploring and experimenting in their own ways. And so I was not particularly experimental, but I before I started studying with them. But I think that both of them are fantastic teachers and certainly helped me develop develop that side of myself as a composer for sure.
Sure. What was your first? Do you remember your first exposure to music? What kind of music was it? And was there kind of a galvanizing moment when you thought, "Wait, I could make music"?
I grew up in a household where we had a lot of different music. NPR, in fact, WFYI was always on, and at that time there was lots of classical music during the day. And so I listened to a lot of classical music. I listened to all of my parents' records. So we had a player piano with piano rolls, so we would listen to lots of old ragtime music.
Cool.
Really all kinds of music, which was a real blessing. I don't really have a one galvanizing moment to contribute to an origin story of remembering when I wanted to become a composer, because I've always experimented with sort of coming up with sounds to create or just writing music just in general. But I think that it occurred to me in college when I started as a music performance major at Butler, and it just sort of eventually I realized, oh, this is what's called being a composer. That's what that's what I want to do.
And percussion was your way in, right?
Right.
Does anybody else in your family play any instrument?
No, I think that everybody in my family at one point played an instrument, you know, just sort of casually in middle school or high school or something like that. My grandfather was an avid organ player and was a music enthusiast just in general, and that was an inspiration for me when I was younger.
When did it hit you that with all of the digital media of today that there were ways of making music beyond old-fashioned acoustic instruments?
I think I don't know. I think that I'm sort of in between the people who are considered digital natives and people who grew up in an exclusively analog time. So it did occur to me when I was in high school eventually that there are lots of people in the pop music world who are clearly using like electronic keyboard samplers and other things. And so I guess it was when I was in high school. but it's hard to say that there was I don't know if there's one particular moment or anything like that, but it seemed so natural to me to use those kinds of tools because I, you know, was sort of finishing growing up with them. So,
how did you get interested in site-specific music?
I haven't actually attended very much site-specific music. I went to a couple of performances when I was in college of things that were site specific that were just done by other student composers.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read about it. You know, I mean, they're events that may be hard. Sometimes a lot of site specific events are hard, things that might be hard to get to, or that are more. Might be more interesting or listenable conceptually than in reality. And I've read about a lot of them, but it's actually not a huge part of what I do as a composer. I think that it's it fits well with what I want to do, and it's a convenient way for people to join together as a sort of spontaneous community to listen to this music and observe what's going on around them. But it's not like a huge, not a huge part of what I do as a composer up to now. But yeah.
What do you want people to do differently, or think about differently, or hear differently after they participate in the event you have up coming up in Indianapolis?
I think the music is timed for the way the light changes, the way that lots of different natural elements move, and so it's my hope through the music that people's minds start to perceive this sort of natural phenomenon that are all around us all the time in a slightly different way, or engage in it in a more active way. So I hope that people will just sort of be able to appreciate the spaces around them in their homes or wherever they are more fully, engage with the moment more fully.
A question I have to ask, so what if it rains?
If it rains, then we will seek shelter and continue to press play. it's raining here in Seattle, so typical.
Yeah.
This morning, and I'm thinking about that. I'm like, well, I'm having five events around the country. I bet at least one of them is going to rain.
So you just go with it. It's a different experience.
Yeah, some of the places have more places where it's easy to grab some shelter. But even if it's raining, or even if it's just cloudy and not raining, the light changing when the sun is just about to set and then just after setting is still interesting and dramatic to observe at that time of day. So I still encourage people to come out even if it's cloudy.
What kind of documenting are you doing of this experience and the others around the country? Are you doing some video or audio recording?
I honestly haven't considered doing any documenting yet. I'm sure that I will be taking pictures, but I haven't thought about doing any documenting besides just documenting that the crowd is there. There isn't going to be any real sound other than because everybody's going to be listening on headphones.
Right.
And I was just going to take some pictures.
Might
lackluster answer.
No, it might take the charm out of it to try to document it too much, too. You know, it's of the moment.
Yeah. So, and I also am hoping that other people will do that for me in the press.
Well, what took you to Seattle?
What drew me to Seattle?
Mm-hmm.
Seattle is known for having a really interesting new music community and experimental music community and music otherwise. And I knew that when I was done with college to continue being a composer, I did not want to go to New York where there are about 8,000 other composers. And there are a lot here, which is it's really great community for that, but you can make your way a little more easily here. The natural surroundings are amazing. The food is amazing here. To be honest, the politics are in line with my own thinking here. So all those things combined.
Kind of makes up for that daily rain.
Yeah.
What is a combination of instruments or instruments and voices that you haven't written for yet that you're really eager to compose for?
Well, you know, I've had a couple of ideas for a saxophone quartet on the back burner that I would like to do at some point. I have never written for full orchestra, which I think would be pretty interesting to do, but there are a lot of people who are more specifically orchestral composers, and that's not really my thing. And what else? Yeah, I don't know. I guess those are two things that I would not mind doing at some point, but I like to experiment with lots of different combinations of instruments that you might not likely think to put together. So I hope to just sort of continue to experiment with new combinations of instruments to create new color patterns and sounds.
And that's a good place to end, because I want to save a little bit of time to be able to drop in a sample of your work there. And depending on exactly how old you are, I used to be a classical announcer here at WFYI when it was mostly classical music during the day, so you probably listen to me part of the time. So I'm sorry, or thank you. I'm not sure which.
No, it's great. I don't know. I mean, I think of classical music as being, I mean, I'm a composer, you know, so surely it must be a thank you, because it was always on.
Thanks to your parents as well, right?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Cool. Well, break a leg. We will see you in a few weeks in Indianapolis. Safe travels, and I'm sure the rain will be over soon.
All right. Thanks, Sharon.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sharon Gamble spoke with composer Nat Evans, Butler University graduate and Indianapolis native. On Sunday, August 7th, people will download Nat's music onto their iPods or other portable listening device ahead of time and arrive at the American Legion Mall at 8:30 p.m. Exactly 10 minutes before sunset, that's 8:41, sunsets at 8:51 that day, Nat will give the cue to press play and participants will sit back and observe while listening. The music, a piece entitled Assemblage, is a mix of new and pre-existing compositions that have been arranged to best complement the changing of light at the pivotal moment of sunset, and will be available to download from the composer's website at natevansmusic.com a week before the event. Right now we're listening to a sample of a previous site-specific piece from Nat Evans. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
You know what's really hot?
Besides everything in our world right now? No, what's really
the
hot?
The arts. What's going on in the arts this weekend? That's what you... Oh, yeah.
I see.
Or maybe it's cool. Maybe now would be a better time for the arts to be cool.
Yeah, I think
cool
it's a good time for the arts to be cool.
Okay, well, let's think of some things we can do to chill with the arts this weekend on the calendar we call.
What'll we do to chill out and cool off? Well, you know what? Back in the day, remember how movie theaters and diners had those cool neon signs that advertised that they were air-conditioned and,
sure,
you know, you would escape to those places? Well, a great thing to do when it's this beastly hot out is go to a museum.
Exactly.
Because, of course, they're temperature-controlled because
of
the art.
They've
got to
be.
And if I can't imagine that you haven't had a chance to do this yet, but just in case you've been procrastinating, don't forget Red Black Related Through History is still up at the Idlejorg. It's running through August 7th, so your chances are dwindling at this point. But it's a great way to learn a little bit more about how African American and Native American cultures are way deeply inclined. And in fact, there's a really interesting talk coming up. If you're hearing us on Friday night, you can go to it tomorrow. If you're hearing us on Saturday afternoon, you just missed it. But it's at 2:30 this Saturday, the 23rd. Like the Indians Themselves, Blacks in the 19th Century Cherokee Nation is the title of the talk. And it's given by a prize-winning author, Dr. Tia Miles. So that's all going on at the Idlejorg. More info at idlejorg.org.
Very cool.
I'm going to hear that again. I just know.
There you go. Hey, a play that's opening this weekend at Theater on the Square is not your traditional play that would be at Theater on the Square, if you know what I mean. it's called The Eel Catchers, and it's actually inspired by a true event that... dealing with the life of Julius Caesar, and about 800 BC, he was actually kidnapped when he was sailing off the Isle of Rhodes. He was kidnapped by some Sicilian pirates, and basically he told them that when they asked for the ransom, that he wasn't asking enough. They weren't asking enough. He was worth that much more, and they should double it. And anyway, this is a play based on all that by Bennett Ayers, and it is opening this weekend at Theater on the Square and runs through August 7th. Sounds kind of fascinating.
I love that. Hey, don't forget, there are still just a handful of tickets left for you ready for this?
Okay.
Cool jazz concert.
Oh, there you go.
Actually, it's fairly hot jazz. It is a concert put on by Isis of Indiana, the women's jazz collective. And this concert celebrates the many styles of Latin American music, history, and culture. And it is a fabulous concert coming up one night only, July 29th, next week, 8 o'clock. at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club. So obviously a cool venue. And, of course, you can have something to eat and a cool beverage there while you're enjoying the likes of Stacy Sandoval and Elizabeth Sousa. So musical genre from salsa, merengue to tango, bossa nova, cha-cha, and lots more. Then don't normally encourage dancing at these concerts,
if you feel
so inclined, check it out.
Who knows? Well, speaking of getting sweaty, I can't even imagine what it's like to be a bicycle courier right now.
Ooh.
But if you are interested in what it's like, the Indie Artist Colony, which is located at 14th and Pennsylvania, is presenting Wild in the Streets on Saturday, July 30th. This starts at noon and it goes till 9. And it is a Gold Star Cycle Courier production. And it's basically a one-day look into the life of being a bicycle courier. And it opens actually with a bicycle race that it's an unsanctioned alley cat race that a bunch of bicycle couriers are going to be starting at 3 o'clock and ending at 5 o'clock. There's also a whole bunch of different things on exhibit, such as photographs, bicycles, parts, jerseys, flyers, bicycles that have been hit by cars while at work.
That's sad.
And also a video premiere of the film Wild in the Streets. It's all about who's the fastest and bravest. Again, at Indie Artist Colony on Saturday, July 30th.
You know, it's important to find your tribe in this life, I'm just saying. And you'll be there unless you're too tired.
Yeah.
That's why
a bicycle
can't stand up. I'm sorry, I got that from a five-year-old who lives in my neighborhood. Here is some cool music. Indie Klez is doing a concert as part of Carmel Community Players World Music Series next Friday, or this coming Friday, depending on how you prefer to phrase it. That's July 29th at 8 o'clock. It's at the Carmel Community Playhouse, and if you've never heard klezmer music live, you need to go check this out. It's klezmer music is enjoying a renaissance among young people, especially people under 25, because it's just infectious. It has jazz elements, it has folk elements, it has all sorts of great groovy dance rhythms. And again, it's a concert, but you know, there's room to dance up at the Carmel Community Playhouse. You can find out more by going to carmelplayers.org. That's a week from Saturday, a week from Friday, Friday, July 29th.
One of the coolest things I could think about doing is volunteering, and right now, two of my favorite festivals are looking for volunteers. One of them is the Indie Fringe, which is coming up in August, and the other is Indie's Irish Fest in September, and they both need lots and lots of volunteers. For the Fringe, now, they've got the main 2011 Indie Fringe Festival, which runs August 19th through the 28th, but there's also the Visual Fringe launch that begins on August 5th, there's the Longest Dinner on the 11th, there's the big opening, there's Club Fringe, and they need volunteers for all of that, and they do have orientations, and you do need to sign up to find out how to volunteer with the Fringe. You can get that information at indyfringe.org, indyfringe.org, and then also for Indie's Irish Fest, September 16th through the 18th, it is an all-volunteer organization and a great one to work with, and they are also looking for lots of volunteers for the 16th annual Indie Irish Fest, and if you go to indyirishfest.com, again, IndieIrishFest.com, you can find out how to volunteer there.
While you have your calendar out thinking about upcoming volunteer opportunities, don't forget that Indie Jazz Fest is looking for volunteers.
Ah, good point.
And Fiesta, also looking for volunteers, both of those coming up in September. Here is an unusual opportunity. The Awareness of Mental Health Through the Performing Arts has received a grant, and they're looking for actors who are receiving or have received mental health services who are interested in participating in a Reader's Theater experience. And they're inviting, if this describes you, they're inviting you to come to one of two organizational meetings. Those are coming up August 8th or 9th at 7 p.m. at Northwood Christian Church. So August 8th or 9th at 7 o'clock, that's in the evening at Northwood Christian Church.
And just a reminder, Dance Kaleidoscope is performing this weekend at the IRT with Summer Musicals, Elvis Sizzle, and that goes on all weekend long at the One America stage at the IRT, and all tickets are $10 for this summer concert, which is very, very cool. It's a great sort of mix of a whole bunch of Dance Kaleidoscope's favorites. The Saturday night concert is at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 2:30.
Excellent. This coming Thursday evening, as part of the Concerts on the Canal at the Indiana History Center, you can hear representatives of Actors Theater of Indiana. They have the Andrews Brothers on stage right now, and they are performing at Concerts on the Canal that Thursday evening, Songs We Knew During World War II, the music of the 1940s. Coincidence? I think not.
Is it a play? Is it a graphic novel? Is it both? It's With a Bang, which is the play that is sort of graphic novel inspired. It's a comedy that is being performed at the Phoenix Theater, and it is playing right now, and it goes through August 14th.
There's another Guthrie. People old enough to have grown up with singer-songwriter Woody Guthrie may know renowned folk artist and songwriter Arlo Guthrie. Yup, he's at Symphony on the Prairie this Saturday night, making his debut at Symphony on the Prairie, along with the ISO's own ensemble in residence, Time for Three. So lots of hot artists together out on the prairie. Take a cool, refreshing beverage to that.
Hey, I did want to mention that last week on Art of the Matter, I talked about how there's a whole bunch of free July previews for the Tarkington Theater.
Yeah.
I've heard all of those are sold out.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is great for them. So there are no more free previews, but there is still the main red carpet curtain raising that's taking place on August 6th, and that is a paid event. You do need to get tickets for that, and that is the one that's featuring David Hyde Pierce from TV. So that should be a lot of fun, as well as some other great performers will be there that night, including, of course, Michael Feinstein.
Love it. What a rare opportunity. This Saturday night at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 are your final two performances, final two opportunities to see a performance, I should say, of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, beautiful family-friendly musical on stage at the Ricks Center for the Arts, presented by the Ricks Weil Theater Company. And that is at 122 West Main Street, Greenfield, Indiana, just a short jaunt from downtown Indianapolis.
There you go. Lots of cool stuff that I'm just hot to see. and we'll be next
Travis,
next week.
Do you hear that sound in the background?
Yeah, what is that?
Do you know
is
what
that moan?
That,
is
no,
that a
no, it's the ice cream truck to cool us off.
Let's go out and get some.
Stay cool out there, and we'll bring you more fun things to do next week on our calendar. We call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Dynasty and Divinity Ife Art in Ancient Nigeria has opened at the Indianapolis Museum of Art this month, and it presents a glimpse of the extraordinary accomplishments of the legendary royal city-state of the Yoruba people from the 12th through the 15th centuries. During this period, Ife was ruled by powerful sacred kings and queens, whose images are captured in stunningly naturalistic cast copper alloy and terracotta heads and figures. Travis DiNicola spoke with the curator, Elizabeth Morton, and with the IMA's public relations manager, Candace Gwaltney, about the exhibit.
Elizabeth, Candace, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Thank you. Nice
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
So, Elizabeth, this is a huge exhibit from what I've been told. I can't wait to see it. I know I've got a little time through January 16th to come see it. But tell me about how you got started working on this. You're actually a professor at Wabash, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Okay, so had you curated anything for the IMA before, or is this your first time?
This is my first time curating an exhibition for the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
Mm-hmm.
I've curated an exhibition at the Carlos Museum in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
and I was a curator at the National Museum Monuments and Art Gallery in the country of Botswana for 5 years.
Wow. Okay. So obviously you've got the background for
yeah.
this. So did the IMA approach you? Did you approach the IMA? I mean, how did this sort of come about for this exhibit to be here?
Well, the exhibition was something that Ted Salenko, who's the curator emeritus of African art at the Indianapolis Museum of Art,
mm-hmm.
got connected to very early on. It was something that the Museum for African Art in New York, this was supposed to be their inaugural exhibition and may still be. They announced a delay in opening their building.
Mm-hmm.
But they had started to arrange this exhibition years and years ago. It's not something that took a little bit of time because it's treasures from somebody else's country. So it really takes a lot of work and a lot of agreements. And this show also was in Spain and England before it came here.
Okay.
So Ted Salenko, the minute he heard about this show.
But this is the first time it's been shown in the United States, is that correct?
This is the first time this show, this is the third venue.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
In the United States.
Okay.
It was at Houston Museum of Fine Arts, and it was at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts.
I see.
And so this is the third venue in the United States, and this is the furthest west it's going to go.
Okay.
But when Ted Salenko heard about this exhibition, he immediately approached the director of the museum and said, we absolutely have to get in on this show. This is one of the most amazing groups of our artworks that exists from Africa. And this is a pioneering show. People know about these works, and some individual pieces have traveled in shows to the United States before. But they've never come as a group before.
Okay. So
the Indianapolis Museum of Art was then a really early committer to getting this show. So it helped to organize the show right from the start.
So how exciting for you to get the opportunity to work on this?
Oh, yeah. It's been absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
When I heard about it and was asked if I would work on this, I knew that it would be something that would be one of the best things that I'd ever done.
Now, you obviously, you know, this is your passion and something that you're very familiar with. But for those of us who are not as familiar with Nigerian art, with African art in general, why is this such an exciting exhibit?
Well, this work, to start with, it's old. It's older than most work you'll find from any part of Africa other than Egypt. Okay. It's from the 9th to the 15th centuries. Mm-hmm. What's really amazing about the work from Ife, though, is its striking naturalism. We don't expect to see naturalism from Africa. It's not really the goal of African art for the most part. But this art is there are a lot of works that are life-size, and they have this incredible naturalism and this incredible technical sophistication. All the works in the show are either stone, carved stone, terracotta, or cast copper alloy. In fact, there's one work that's almost pure copper, which is a really technically difficult thing to produce. In terms of their style, though, this is something that there's nothing like it in Africa in terms of just how realistic these works are.
That's what really struck me from just the photographs I've seen on the website and some information I've seen. As I said, I haven't had a chance to see it in person yet, but very realistic, very naturalistic, and just a beautiful work. But it seems like it's also, as you said, I mean, something that technically is very impressive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, another thing that's really interesting about this work is that it comes from a place that is in modern day Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And it's in a state, from a city that is part of the Yoruba people. Mm-hmm. The Yoruba people are one of the largest cultural groups in Nigeria, which makes them one of the largest cultural groups in Africa. And the Yoruba claim that this is the place that the world began. Mm-hmm. Their creation myth comes from Ife, from this particular city. So that's another thing that really lends something quite fascinating about these works, although we don't really know too much about them because they weren't discovered until the 20th century. We do know that the location of them is extremely significant, both ritually and historically, for the Yoruba.
Well, tell me about how were they discovered? Was it intentional, unintentional? I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, were people, you know, digging for artifacts, or did they just sort of stumble upon it? You know?
Well, the very first work was discovered in 1910 by a German explorer named Leo Frobenius. He actually had gone to Nigeria and he'd heard that there were some interesting works inland. Had heard that they were in wood, or stone, and was quite surprised when he came to a ritual grove, a grove for a particular goddess of the sea named Olokun, and there was this incredible naturalistic cast copper alloy head with a crown embedded into the image. And he went back to Europe and he told people that he had found the lost colony of Atlantis. You know, because of course that was they do have that kind of naturalism that reminds us of ancient Greek and ancient Roman works. Now, it wasn't until 1938 that during construction of a building and digging a foundation that they actually discovered a cache of cast metal heads. So the first group of objects to be discovered was in 1938.
Okay. Yeah. Now going back to when these works were created by the Ife, I know that we don't know a whole lot about them. But, I mean, is there any sense that there was an influence from the Greeks or Romans? Or, I mean, I know that, I mean, there's such a huge gap of years there, but aesthetically there does seem to be a similarity.
No, there's really no relationship at all as far as we know. And, in fact, there was an early article in the London Illustrated News that compared these to Donatello, and they called this the Donatellos of Africa. That's even a bit problematic because these works predate the works from Ife predate Donatello by decades, possibly centuries.
Okay.
And so it really was something that was happening. This life-size naturalism was something that was being done quite apart from the West. The metal that was used in them wasn't imported. It came from Africa. They're pretty certain now that it came from a mine in modern-day Niger.
Okay.
It's a bit of a mystery.
It is a mystery, like how they sort of even the techniques, how they discovered them.
Mm-hmm. Casting metal is not easy. Anyone mm-hmm. who's ever tried to do it knows that even the simplest lost wax process is very, very difficult.
So what have you learned through working on curating this exhibit?
In what way?
Well, in that, I mean, certainly, you know, this is your field, but, you know, in working on an exhibit, being so close to it and intimate with an exhibit like this over time, I'd imagine there's got to be something sort of new or unexpected that you come across.
I think certainly by working on this, I've learned a lot more about the works that surround that are sort of in a cluster of works around this. And that's one of the things that's nice about this show.
How do you mean?
Well, the cast copper heads are something that's really well known, but mm-hmm. the work also has, the exhibition also has a bunch of works that are made out of terracotta that show a lot of different kinds of images that come from Ife. There are people with deformities, there are diseased people, there are human sacrifices, there are animals that to be sacrificed. So they give us this kind of interesting picture of Ife. Mm-hmm. The term dynasty comes from the fact that a lot of the figures are crowned.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that in terms of the legends of the Yoruba, Ife is where the first king was. The one of the gods that was part of creation became the first king of the Yoruba. And then he had 16 sons to whom he gave 16 crowns.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that we've got images. We can look at these images and we can see that they're images of royalty in this show. But there are also a lot of images of the world that surrounds a divine royalty,
mm-hmm.
Which includes a lot of ritual. It includes a lot of people that are serving that royal class, people who are obviously of high status as well. They're beautiful, beautiful images of men and women with beautiful hairstyles and nice hats and some scarification sometimes, some beauty marks.
Hmm. Well, it just sounds like a great exhibit and such interesting work. Now, I know that the IMA is certainly very excited, Candace, to be able to show this exhibit this summer and through January 16th. And there's a number of other sort of events that are tied to it, plus always a ton of things going on at the IMA that would love to hear about from you.
Oh, sure. We're actually very excited to be partnering with Indigo this summer and in part with this exhibition. So we are participating in the Indigo Summer Youth Pass.
Mm-hmm.
So any youth age 18 and under that has one of these summer passes can come to the museum and actually see this exhibition for free, as well as our other special exhibition we have going on right now, which is Hard Truths, the Art of Thornton Dial. So
awesome.
We're hoping to see a lot of young people out at the museum to see the Ife exhibition.
Yeah, that's a great partnership with Indigo
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And and certainly, you know, a great way to spend a day to come out there and check out the exhibits. Also, as we're recording this, of course, the International Film Festival is going, or the Indie Film Festival is going on out there as well. And then you've got your summer nights and all types of good things always going on out there.
Right, right. And, of course, 100 Acres.
Yeah.
So
and
always something to do.
A year later now with 100 Acres. It's been.
Time flies.
Yeah.
We've really had a lot of great community feedback with the park, and always happy to see the crowds out there.
Mm-hmm. So. Awesome. Always a great place to spend a summer day. You know, I want to give you the opportunity, Elizabeth, to have sort of the last word here, if you will. What is it that you would think would be most helpful to know for someone who's going to this exhibit to really appreciate what they're going to see? What would you want to tell someone before they walk in?
I'd want you to know that Africa has great things. This is just one of the many great things that Africa has. We have stereotypes about what we think African art should be, and I hope that this exhibition will change your mind about what African art can be. Obviously, the first person who saw this work from the West determined that it was too great to be African. It had to be ancient Greek or ancient Roman. He didn't even assign it to the Europeans, you know, interestingly.
Atlantis.
You know, yeah. I really hope that you will think about coming out. Come and see something really unique. And there's another thing that's great about this. This is another country's treasures. And it's really something special for somebody to send their top treasures to another country. They've really been entrusted to the United States. I think it's wonderful that Indianapolis is one of the stops on this tour.
Travis DiNicola and IMA curator Elizabeth Morton and public relations manager Candace Gwaltney. The exhibit Dynasty and Divinity Ife Art in Ancient Nigeria is open now through January 16th at the IMA. Visit imamuseum.org for more information. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buseli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I chat with painter Douglas David about the work he is exhibiting at this year's State Fair.
I'll find out about a Lincoln Highway Road Rally in northern Indiana.
Wow. And I'll get a preview of this year's Drum Corps International World Championships taking place right here at Lucas Oil Stadium. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Summer at the Palladium, now through August. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.